The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Susan Dellinger from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from Oprah Magazine, February 2019, Volume 20, Number 2. And this is the fourth of four installments of the February issue. Oprah is very casual on this month's cover. She's wearing gray suede pants and a blush pink sweatshirt with the word "Cher" written on the front. Her hair is a mass of highlighted shoulder-length curls. This month's headline is a quote from Oprah. Every person has a story with the power to crack you wide open. And let's start out with From the Live Your Best Life section of the magazine, part two of a series from Martha Beck. And this one is entitled Center of Attention. After years of struggling with compulsive eating, Jessica Pell longs to feel at home in her body. The first step, says O Life Coach Martha Beck, is learning how to feel at home in the world. Weight has been, quote, the bane of my family's existence, end of quote, says Jessica Pell, 47, of New York City. Her parents, who both had been chubby as kids, focused on diets, exercise, and all too often, their daughter's weight problem. Jessica has long relied on food to soothe herself. After graduate school, she gained a significant amount, then dropped 150 pounds, getting down to a size 8. 7 years later, however, she's fallen into her old binging patterns, and the number on the scale has crept back up. Frustrated, Jessica called Martha Beck, who told her that the first step toward breaking a habit is to detach and observe it. Jessica gamely agreed to try an exercise called The Wild Child and the Dictator, in which she'd imagine both the needy part of herself that seeks food for comfort and the critical part of herself that wants to control her compulsive eating, then simply wish the two of them peace. How did it go? Let's check in on their second session. Martha. Hi, Jessica. What's going on? Did you try the exercise? Jessica. Yes. I tried to find toy figures to represent the wild child and the dictator because it helps me to focus on something tangible. The closest I could find to the wild child was Pigpen from Peanuts. And she laughs. Then a friend and I went to a spa where we tried meditation. I'm not crunchy, but I'm trying to get out of my comfort zone. We used malas, those strings of prayer beads, and I found that holding one helped me stay focused during the exercise. Martha, very creative. Jessica, the more I practice, the more I understand how it feels not to be stuck as the wild child or the dictator. I just observe them. It's stepping outside that cycle of binging and punishment. Martha, amazing. You deserve a reward. Jessica, well, I usually reward myself with cake, which is not a good idea. Martha, so let's talk about the food. Have you felt any changes? Jessica, I've felt more anxious, but maybe that's good. It means I'm thinking about the issues instead of just being sad. I'm trying to resist the urge to say to myself, now that you're working with Martha, you have to get it in gear. People are going to be asking how much weight you've lost. Martha, I'd like to switch that message. There's so much cultural pressure on everybody to be thin. What about selecting a goal that doesn't involve your physical body? You know, there are cells in your body that are constantly being replaced, so the body you have now is not the same one that you had 10 years ago. But there's a consciousness inside you that never changes. That's the essential you, the one thing you'll take all the way to the end of this life. So I'm not concerned about what you'll look like in 6 months. I'm interested in your peace of mind. If you can grow that, you won't care so much what people think of your weight. Jessica, the idea of not caring what other people think makes me anxious. What if I just let myself go even more? And it's not just what other people think, it's how I feel. I'm very uncomfortable in my own skin. Martha, When I talk about not caring, I don't mean you should tell everyone else to shove it. I'm talking about being so present in your own life that there's no room to worry about other people's judgment. To give an extreme example, imagine you were in a hospital ward full of babies and someone said, "There's a fire. We've got to get the babies to safety." Your weight would not be at the forefront of your attention. You would be completely focused on the task at hand. Jessica, I get that. My dad and I always say if we can reclaim all the brain power we've put into thinking about weight, we could have cured cancer by now. Not that we're geniuses, but it's so much wasted energy. Martha, exactly. And alleviating the pressure of worrying about other people's judgment alleviates anxiety, which is what's driving you to binge. If you keep doing the wild child exercise and practicing mindfulness and equanimity, you'll replace the anxiety about what you look like with compassion for yourself and others. The need to comfort yourself with food will go away because you won't need to be comforted. You'll already be comforted. Does that make sense? Jessica, yes. Martha, self-compassion is what will help you break the cycle of food addiction. I would love to see you stop being violent to yourself. You say to yourself things that you would never say to a friend. Jessica, I think about that a lot. How I'm nicer to people in line at Starbucks than I am to myself. You know, I actually compliment strangers all the time. I don't know what this is about, but I feel like I want to cry. Martha, this is exactly where we needed to go, my dear. Jessica, when I was growing up, my mom was constantly pointing out other women on TV, in stores, and saying, "Look how beautiful, look at that figure." It's like I'm looking at people the same way. I'll compliment them, but then I'll get a lump in my throat. Martha, when people grow up being criticized about their weight, they can go one of two ways. One is to viciously attack others the way they were attacked. You've chosen the other path. You're offering the admiration you never received yourself. We all need it. So many people walk around feeling that they're not good enough. Jessica, it takes so little to make people happy. They may look standoffish, but you tell them something nice and they say, "You made my day." Martha, let's try turning some of that compassion and admiration toward yourself. I'm looking right at you, and there is a tremendous amount of beauty to be found there. I can tell you don't believe me. Jessica, it's so cliched, but all I can think about is, "You have such a pretty face." When people say that, you know what they really mean. Martha, let's take the physical out of it for now, because that's so loaded. I'll tell you what else I see. You're funny, smart, warm, loving. And this is only the second time we've met. Jessica, I'm happy to hear that. It's hard, though. Out in the world, I hear a running commentary about how people are judging me, even though I know it's illogical. Martha, that's why I want to forget about their thoughts and focus on changing your thoughts. Whatever you project, you see reflected back from the world. You feel unattractive, and you're looking for every tiny shred of evidence that validates that bias, right? Jessica, totally. The other day, I was walking down the street, and a man approached me and said, "You look like a big..." I immediately thought, "Big girl." I was convinced I knew how he was going to finish the sentence. Do you know what he actually said? "Big animal lover." He was collecting money for an animal shelter. I thought, I can't keep doing this. Martha, wow. Okay, when you're walking along and you start imagining all the awful things you believe other people are thinking, I'd like you to consciously redirect your attention to all the wonderful things that you are. Funny, smart, warm, loving. Repeat it like a mantra. You don't even have to believe it. We're just trying to change those old negative patterns in your brain. If you can come around to focusing on what's good about you, you'll begin to project those qualities. And that's what you'll see reflected back. You mentioned that the mala beads help you focus. Jessica, they do. Martha, I'd love it if you'd buy yourself a pretty piece of jewelry like a ring. It doesn't have to be expensive. Whenever you notice you're being hateful to yourself, touch it and recite that mantra of positive qualities. Every time you do, you're helping change those old patterns of self-punishment. It will require repetition, because how many of those critical thoughts have you had over the course of your life? Probably millions, if not billions. But keep at it. And I'd like you to keep going with the wild child and the dictator, too. Jessica, I'm game. Martha, okay, gorgeous. See you in a few weeks. Let's head over to the Let's Eat section of the magazine now, and we'll look at some recipes for carrots. And we have a plate full of roasted carrots, some of the tops still on. They're whole carrots. And the article is entitled Raise the Root. These simple spiced carrots from Danielle Walker's Eat What You Love do justice to the humble vegetable. As a child, I wasn't especially fond of cooked carrots. Was anyone? I associated them with the overly sweet, glazed variety, or worse, those steamed, soggy logs. And as a new mom, I ran into the same problem with my oldest son. It wasn't until I was enjoying a curry dish and pulled out a few of the carrots for him that he finally ate them. That moment helped me realize that children's palates can be more adventurous than we give them credit for. So I stopped preparing two separate vegetables at dinner time and started feeding my son what we were eating, including those tender roasted carrots tossed in a salty coconut aminos, a soy sauce alternative I turned to after I gave up soy and gluten, and an earthy, spicy blend. That little boy, who's now 8, looks forward to helping me make them, and he's also influenced his 2 younger siblings to enjoy carrots, cooked, raw, or any which way. So here's the recipe for cumin roasted carrots. This makes 4 to 6 servings with a total time of 45 minutes. And here are the ingredients. 1 pound of small carrots, scrubbed and trimmed. 2 tablespoons of avocado oil. 2 tablespoons of coconut aminos. Look for it near the soy sauce in your grocery store. 3/4 teaspoon of ground cumin. 1/4 teaspoon of ground coriander. 1/4 teaspoon of ground ginger. 1/4 teaspoon of fine sea salt. 1/4 cup chopped cilantro leaves for garnish. 2 tablespoons of roasted pepitas for garnish. And here are the instructions. Preheat the oven to 400 degrees. On a rimmed baking sheet, toss together carrots, oil, coconut aminos, cumin, coriander, ginger, and salt. Spread in a single layer and roast for 15 minutes. Flip carrots and roast until fork tender, 10 to 15 minutes more. Transfer to a serving dish, sprinkle with cilantro and pepitas, and serve warm. And now we have some more recipes under the headline, Let Them Eat Cakes. And the first example here is a photograph of a chocolate layer cake with all these creamy layers of frosting or icing in between. And it looks like there are some coffee beans sprinkled across the top. This is espresso martini layer cake. And there's a little subheading here that says mellow out. Add a playful twist to this buzzy treat by topping it with mini marshmallows, suggests Christina Tossi, pastry chef behind New York City's beloved Milk Bar Bakery and author of All About Cake. And then the next picture is a bundt cake with grated orange peel on it and some kind of delicious looking glaze as well. And it's called Triple Citrus Bundt Cake. And under the little subheading Zest Practices, don't let your zested citrus go to waste. Tossi recommends folding cut-up orange segments from 2 medium oranges into the batter for juicy texture and added zing. And then under the heading Let Them Eat Cakes, The tender texture, the fluff and frosting. There's lots to love about a great cake. We've got five you might want to whip up for someone special. We turn the page and we have a cappuccino icebox cake, which looks like it might be coffee-flavored ice cream, maybe. And it looks like it's been made in a loaf pan, like you might bake a loaf of bread in it. And it has those thin chocolate wafers lining the sides, and it's had chocolate drizzled over the top. Snack hack is the subheading. Tossie's tip for a salty surprise, replace the chocolate wafers with crushed pretzels. And then we have a cranberry swirl cheesecake. It's got a chocolate crust and, of course, the creamy cheesecake and then red marbling effect on the top. Oh, snap, says the subheading. Tossie says, to spice things up, try using ginger snap cookies for the crust. Their zippy flavor will complement the tart cranberry. And now we have one final cake. Oh, these all look good enough to eat. Again, this is in a loaf pan, and it's hot cocoa marble pound cake. And from the top, it's absolutely exquisite with its yellow cake and chocolate marbled in, and they've sliced some slices. And under the subheading, it says, give it a whirl. Using buttermilk instead of whole milk makes this cake extra tender with a touch of tang. Prefer a bittersweet treat? Swap the hot cocoa mix for unsweetened cocoa powder. Now, here are the instructions for the espresso martini layer cake. It makes 12 to 14 servings with a total time of 55 minutes. Here are the ingredients for the cake. 14 tablespoons of unsalted butter, melted, plus more for greasing the pan. 9 ounces, about 2 cups, of self-rising flour. 1 teaspoon of baking soda, a half a cup of cocoa powder sifted, a half a cup of light brown sugar, a half a cup of sugar, a pinch of salt, 5 ounces, about 2/3 cup, of sour cream, 3 large eggs, 1 teaspoon of vanilla extract, 2 tablespoons of espresso or strong coffee cooled, 2 tablespoons of Kahlua, 1 tablespoon of chocolate-covered coffee beans. For the espresso syrup, a half a cup of espresso or strong coffee cooled, 3 tablespoons of Kahlua, 2/3 cup of sugar. And for the icing, now remember, this is the chocolate layer cake. 14 ounces of cream cheese softened, 7 tablespoons of unsalted butter softened, a pinch of salt, 3/4 cup confectioner sugar sifted, 2 teaspoons of espresso powder, 1 tablespoon of whole milk. And here are the instructions. Preheat oven to 350 degrees. Grease 2 8-inch round cake pans and line with parchment paper. To a large bowl, add flour, baking soda, cocoa powder, sugars, and salt. In a medium bowl, whisk sour cream, eggs, and vanilla to combine. Add the wet ingredients to the dry ingredients and whisk until fully incorporated. Then whisk in melted butter, coffee, and Kahlua. Divide mixture equally between prepared pans. Bake until risen and firm, 25 to 30 minutes. Let cool in pans for 10 minutes, then transfer to a wire rack to cool completely. To make the syrup, to a small saucepan, add espresso, Kahlua, and sugar. Heat on low until sugar dissolves, then increase heat and simmer until reduced and syrupy, 4 to 5 minutes. Set aside to cool. When cakes are cool, cut each in half horizontally to make 4 even layers. Drizzle each layer, cut side up, with 1 tablespoon of espresso syrup. To make icing, whisk together cream cheese, butter, salt, and confectioner's sugar until smooth. Dissolve espresso powder in milk, add to mixture, and whisk until combined. To assemble, place the first layer, cut side up, on a cake stand, spread with a thin layer of icing, top with another cake layer, and repeat twice more, using all remaining icing on top layer, cut side down. Sprinkle with coffee beans and drizzle with remaining syrup. And now, here are the instructions for the triple citrus bundt cake. This makes 10 to 12 servings with a total time of an hour and 20 minutes. For the cake, 16 tablespoons, 2 sticks of unsalted butter softened, plus more for greasing the pan. 3 cups of all-purpose flour, plus more for dusting the pan. 1/2 teaspoon of baking soda. 1 teaspoon of baking powder. 2 teaspoons of cinnamon. 1/2 teaspoon of salt. 2 cups of sugar. 1 8-ounce package of cream cheese softened. 2 teaspoons of grated lemon zest. 1 teaspoon of grated orange zest. 1 teaspoon of grated lime zest. 6 large eggs at room temperature. 4 teaspoons of vanilla extract. Now for the icing, 3 tablespoons of orange juice, 2 tablespoons of lemon juice, 2 tablespoons of lime juice. Now that's the triple citrus. 1 1/4 cups confectioner's sugar sifted. Candied citrus peel cut into strips, optional. And here are the instructions. Preheat oven to 325 degrees. Grease and lightly flour a 12-cup bundt pan. In a large bowl, whisk together flour, baking soda, baking powder, cinnamon, and salt. In another large bowl, using an electric mixer on medium speed, beat sugar, butter, cream cheese, and zests until smooth. Beat in eggs one at a time. Scraping sides of bowl is needed, then beat in vanilla. In 2 batches, beat in flour mixture until just combined. To the pan, add batter and smooth the top. Bake until a toothpick inserted into the center comes out clean, about 1 hour. Cool completely on a wire rack. Meanwhile, to a small bowl, add juices and confectioner's sugar and mix until smooth. Brush icing over cooled cake and let sit until somewhat set. Garnish with strips of candied citrus peel if desired. Now, here on the sidebar, it says dessert fix, Christina Tossi's pro advice for better baking. Cake mistake? Trusting your oven. Everyone's is different, so use a thermometer to ensure that yours really is at the right temperature and avoid under or over baking. Plus, a too hot oven can result in side sets and jiggly middles. Try the OXO Chef Precision Oven Thermometer, $13, OXO.com, which clips on an oven rack and stays put. Here's another cake mistake. Under creaming. Tossi says, I would go so far as to say that creaming is the most important step in baking, so take it seriously. Cream your batter and sugar on high speed in a stand mixer fitted with a paddle attachment or using a handheld mixer until light and feathery, about 2 to 3 minutes, scraping down the sides of the bowl halfway through. This will fully dissolve the sugar while incorporating small pockets of air into the batter, making for the fluffiest baked goods. And now we have 3 more cakes. And the third one is cappuccino icebox cake. This makes 10 to 12 servings for a total time of 20 minutes plus chilling. Here are the ingredients. 1 8-ounce package of cream cheese softened. 1 1/2 cups of heavy cream chilled. 1/4 cup unsweetened cocoa powder. 1 tablespoon espresso powder. 1/4 teaspoon of salt. 1 teaspoon of vanilla extract. 1/2 cup of sugar. 1 9-ounce package chocolate wafer cookies, like Nabisco famous chocolate wafers. 2 ounces of dark or semi-sweet chocolate melted for drizzling. And here are the instructions. In a large bowl, using an electric mixer on medium-high speed, beat cream cheese, heavy cream, cocoa, and espresso powders, salt, and vanilla until soft peaks form. Gradually beat in sugar until stiff peaks form. Line an 8.5 by 4.5 inch loaf pan with plastic wrap. Line bottom and sides of pan with cookies. To the pan, add 1/2 of the batter. Spread into an even layer. Top with double layer of cookies. You may not need all the cookies. Over the cookies, pour the remaining batter and spread evenly. Cover pan with plastic wrap and refrigerate overnight. And finally, uncover the pan and invert the cake onto a cutting board or a flat plate. Remove plastic wrap and carefully flip cake onto a serving platter. Drizzle with melted chocolate. Serve immediately or refrigerate covered up to 2 days. And here's our fourth cake, which is the cranberry swirl cheesecake. This makes 10 to 12 servings for a total time of 1 hour and 40 minutes plus the chilling. And here are the ingredients. 1/2 cup fresh or frozen cranberries. 1/2 cup frozen raspberries. 1 teaspoon of grated orange zest. 1/4 cup of orange juice. 1 cup of sugar divided. 4 tablespoons of unsalted butter melted, plus more for greasing pan. 1 9-ounce package chocolate wafer cookies. 3 8-ounce packages of cream cheese softened. 3/4 cups sour cream. 2 tablespoons of all-purpose flour. 2 teaspoons of vanilla extract. 1 pinch of salt. 3 eggs. Here are the instructions. In a medium saucepan over medium heat, combine cranberries, raspberries, orange zest, and juice, and 1/4 cup of sugar. Simmer, stirring occasionally until cranberries burst and sauce thickens, 5 to 7 minutes. Transfer a mixture to a food processor and puree until smooth. Strain into a medium bowl, let cool for 10 minutes, then refrigerate until ready to use. Preheat oven to 375 degrees. Coat a 9-inch springform pan with butter. Clean and dry food processor. Pulse chocolate wafers to form fine crumbs. Add butter and pulse to incorporate. Into the bottom and 2.5 inches upsides of pan press crumb mixture. Bake until crust is set and fragrant, 10 to 12 minutes. Transfer to a wire rack to cool. Reduce oven temperature to 325 degrees. While crust cools, in a large bowl, using an electric mixer on medium speed, combine cream cheese, sour cream, flour, vanilla, salt, and remaining 3/4 cup sugar until smooth. Beat in eggs one at a time. Transfer 1/2 cup of batter to a bowl and set aside. Pour remaining batter into cooled crust. Whisk reserved filling into cranberry mixture and dollop large spoonfuls over batter in crust. Using a knife, swirl cranberry batter through plain filling. Don't over-swirl or colors will turn muddy. Bake until cheesecake is set around edges and center jiggles just slightly when nudged. 45 to 50 minutes. Transfer pan to a wire rack and let cool completely, then refrigerate, loosely covered for about 4 hours or overnight. Remove rim of springform pan before serving. And our final recipe is hot cocoa marble pound cake. This makes 10 to 12 servings with a total time of 1 hour and 40 minutes. Here are the ingredients. 12 tablespoons, 1.5 sticks of unsalted butter, plus more for greasing pan. 2 1/4 cups all-purpose flour, plus more for dusting pan. 1 1/2 teaspoons of baking powder, 1/2 teaspoon of kosher salt, 3/4 cup sugar, 4 large eggs, 2 teaspoons of vanilla extract, 3/4 cup whole milk, 1/4 cup hot cocoa mix. Here are the instructions. Preheat oven to 325 degrees, butter and flour, an 8.5 by 4.5 inch loaf pan. In a medium bowl, whisk together flour, baking powder, and salt. In a large bowl, using an electric mixer on medium speed, beat butter and sugar until light and fluffy, about 3 minutes. Reduce speed to low and beat in eggs one at a time, then vanilla. Alternately, add flour mixture and milk, mixing until just incorporated. In a medium bowl, combine hot cocoa mix with 1 tablespoon of boiling water. Add 1/2 cup vanilla batter and mix to make chocolate batter. Into prepared pan, spoon 1/3 of vanilla batter and top with small dollops of 1/3 of chocolate batter, about 2.5 tablespoons total. Repeat twice, ending with chocolate dollops. using a butter knife, swirl mixture in figure eight pattern a couple of times. Don't over swirl or mixture will become muddy. Bake until a toothpick inserted in the center comes out clean, 70 to 75 minutes. Let cool in pan for 5 minutes, then transfer to a wire rack to cool completely. And finally, we have two more tips under the heading Dessert Fix. Cake mistake, going stir crazy. Mixing too long when flour is involved will encourage gluten formation, which can make your cake chewier and denser than you want. To prevent this, stop mixing as soon as you no longer see any powder. Scrape down the sides of the bowl and finish off with another stir or two by hand. And our final cake mistake, following the rules. It may surprise you to hear this coming from a pastry chef, but I'm a fan of straying from the recipe to get a creative result. Want to change up a jam layer with a tier of your favorite fresh berries? Go for it. Craving a good crunchy element? Add some texture with cake crumbs or pretzels. Our work at Milk Bar helped us win 2 James Beard Awards, and half our recipes are the result of what if? Let's head over now to the reading room. And the first review we're going to read is entitled The Departed, and it is a review of the book The Dreamers. In Karen Thompson Walker's hypnotic second novel, nightmares come to pass. At the start of The Dreamers, the touching and terrifying novel by the author of The Age of Miracles, Kara, a college freshman in a fictional Southern California town, takes to her dorm bed and doesn't wake up. Soon her mysterious sleeping sickness spreads through the isolated forest area, and an ensemble of residents must contend with the competing goals of surviving, protecting their loved ones from falling victim to the epidemic, and lending a hand to strangers who might affect them. The allegorical outbreak, like the one in José Saramago's 1995 masterpiece Blindness, which inspired Walker to write this book, acts as a lens through which to examine a host of contemporary issues, from climate change. One character has stockpiled supplies for himself and his daughters in anticipation of environmental Armageddon. To civil rights, people are removed from their homes and involuntarily quarantined for weeks on end. Walker's roving, fictive eye, by turns, probes characters' innermost feelings and zooms out to coolly parse topics like reality versus delusion. The shifting perspective mirrors the fluid omniscience of the dreamlike musings comatose patients experience, and the actual dreams the as-yet unafflicted confront in their reluctant and dreaded slumbers. The dreamer's sinister sleep provides the perfect ambiguous frame for a tense and layered plot, turning a familiar part of life into a threat. It's left to the reader to decide whether what's happening is psychosomatic, physiological, or even magical, like a spell in a fairy tale. Novels that inventively engage with the terrors of our times feel ever more urgent now. But within Walker's dystopia, ordinary people endure and love, and the intricate dynamics of interlocking lives speak to both a society's fragility and its strengths. The next review is entitled Tangled Roots, and it's a review of the book Inheritance. A writer sets out to explore her genealogy and gets the surprise of her life. Dani Shapiro has spent her career and 4 previous memoirs grappling with the notion of self, and in particular, her Orthodox Jewish Polish lineage, which has largely defined her and her oeuvre. So when DNA results revealed that her biological father is actually a retired doctor living in the Pacific Northwest, a non-Jewish sperm donor from the early years of IVF, Shapiro, 54, quote, felt cut loose from everything I had ever understood about myself, end quote. In her new autobiographical work, Inheritance, she asks, who am I? and must accept that among all the family mysteries that she has sought to unravel, quote, the secret was me, end of quote. Shapiro confronts and reimagines her identity, this time on the molecular level, with the help of scientists, rabbis, relatives, her own memory, letters, and of course Google. The writing is that of a true storyteller who will not stop until she has bored down to the bottom of where she came from, and in this she is at her narrative best. Addressing the complex territory of easy order DNA testing kits promising to tell, quote, a more complete story of you, end of quote, inheritance proves that asking what makes a person who they are yields far more difficult and nuanced answers than a cheek swab ever could. Our next review is entitled Arrested Development, and it is a review of the book Sugar Run. A darkly steamy first novel stars an ex-con wrestling with freedom. The protagonist of Misha Marin's ravishingly rugged Sugar Run was 17 when she was sentenced to life in prison. Now 35, Jody is out and left, quote, spinning like a broken compass, end of quote. En route to West Virginia to rehabilitate her grandmother's derelict cabin, she hooks up with Miranda, an addict and young mother in the midst of divorcing her husband, a washed-up country singer who funneled his band's royalties into Scientology. Sugar Run is a literary page-turner, hair-raising in both plot and prose. Marin writes with windswept grace and stark sensuality. Jody's visions of Appalachia teem with the, quote, smell of wheat in the field and sunlight scissoring through the trees, end of quote. The nascent bond between Jody and Miranda is cut with flashbacks revealing how teenage Jody landed in jail after falling under the spell of an older woman who expanded her world and also led her astray. These sections are in present tense, acknowledging that Jody's past is never behind her. She may no longer be incarcerated, but she remains constrained by shame. In this rough and tumble southern noir, there are no quick fixes. Mistakes once made can't be undone, especially when, as Jody reflects, quote, she laid the old pattern over her new life, end of quote. And on the sidebar, under the heading Poetry Pause, we have a quote from Magical Negro by Morgan Parker. If you cut open my heart, it would be midnight. At the greatest party of all time, a miniature. Sean Carter and Andre Lorde feasting on difference. I carry us all in me. Our next review is of the book Hollywood's Eve, and the review is called All About Eve. In the 60s and 70s, Eve Babbitts was L.A.'s holly-go-lightly, known for her elan, her many lovers, among them Jim Morrison and Harrison Ford, and her friendships with cultural icons from Didion to Dolly. She aspired to be an artist, but her reputation as a hard-partying it girl overshadowed her work, and drinking and drugs took a toll. Eventually, though, she found her footing as a writer and in 1974 published Eve's Hollywood, the first of seven books to draw on her insider experience of SoCal in all its glory and grit. Hollywood's Eve by Lily Analik indulges its author's obsession with Babbitts, whom she views as an underrated literary genius whose addictions nearly led her off a cliff. There's lots of gossip here, but what makes the book fascinating is that even a reporter as well-versed as Analik in all things Babbitts can't decide whether her idol is a casualty of her sexuality or a feminist heroine finally getting her due. Either way, it's impossible not to be infatuated. And next, we have an article called Head Over Heels, still in the reading room. If you thought Sarah Jessica Parker's primary obsession was shoes, think again. In 2016, Sarah Jessica Parker became editorial director of the newly launched SJP for Hogarth, a literary imprint of Crown Publishing. Her first acquisition, A Place for Us by Fatima Farheen Mirza, was a debut novel about an Indian family in America striving to adjust to their new country. It went on to become a New York Times bestseller. Her second pick, Golden Child by Claire Adam, is also a first novel. It has the palpable tension of a thriller, but abounds with socio-political themes. In a Trinidad rife with corruption and crime, a son's kidnapping forces his father to choose between his two children. The tale highlights the brutally unwinnable situations many would-be immigrants face. O's Books editor, Lee Haber, asked Parker, who is also honorary chair of the American Library Association's Book Club Central, for which she regularly designates books to share with readers across the country, what draws her to a story and why she decided to lend her name to this new endeavor. Lee Haber, where did your passion for reading come from? Sarah Jessica Parker, my mother is the reason all of her 8 children are readers. She used to drive us everywhere with either a book or the New Yorker opened on her lap. At red lights, she would look down and read. We'd poke her on the shoulder when the light turned green. She spent her life taking us to ballet classes, violin and piano lessons, everywhere. I'm pretty sure the reason she didn't lose her mind was that all that going on here and there afforded her time to read. Now that I'm a mother, I understand completely. Lee, do you do the same? Sarah, absolutely. I get to brownie pickup early so I can read while I'm waiting for my girls. I purposely take the subway to bury my head in a book. On movie and television sets, I'm never without a book. So when I'm in hair and makeup or between takes, I can read. Sometimes people get offended because they think I'm being antisocial, but it's actually a way for me to stay focused. Lee, I heard that when Molly Stern, the publisher of Hogarth, first suggested you create a book imprint, you thought, oh, I'm not qualified. Why did you change your mind? Sarah, I've already joined a book club with some writers and publishing people in part, so I could read forthcoming titles early and then support them any way I could by posting on Instagram and Twitter, just talking them up or letting paparazzi take a picture of me carrying a certain book. The first thing we read together was Anthony Mara's A Constellation of Vital Phenomena, which I fell madly in love with. The whole purpose of the club was to help great books get a leg up, and the experience was wonderful. Then 3 years in, Molly suggested I could have an even bigger impact by handpicking a list of books and working on them from start to finish. Lee, agents send you tons of submissions. Why did you choose Golden Child from the piles? Sarah, right away, I was utterly absorbed. I was concerned for the characters. I felt loving toward them. I couldn't stop thinking about the father's dilemma, the challenges he was facing, and how hard it is to be a good parent, especially when the economics are so tough and you're faced with life or death choices that no one, especially a parent, should have to make. Lee, those characters got to you. Sarah, yes. Their lives are obviously so different from mine, yet I deeply related to what they were going through, and I wanted contentment, satisfaction, peace for them. Their pain was mine, which meant the author had done something pretty remarkable. Lee, the desperation they feel to give their children a better life is visceral and offers the reader a deeper understanding of, say, why someone from Trinidad might do just about anything to come to the United States. Sarah, and the beauty of it is that Golden Child isn't a political book. It doesn't address policy issues, but you feel that, yes, in some ways, this family is as stuck as someone in a jail cell. Lee, we may travel to islands in the Caribbean as tourists, but we don't know what's really happening there. Sarah, it made me ashamed, frankly. Yes, the novel's set on a beautiful sunny island, but it's also a real place with people struggling in ways we wouldn't be able to imagine absent the book. Lee, One of your goals in finding new literary voices is to help foster an understanding about the larger world. In other words, empathy. Sarah, I truly believe that reading accomplishes this as nothing else can. There's a solitude to it, and in that sense, it's very different from watching a film or a play. Good books transport you. Of course, you can never be somebody else, have their DNA, live their story, but you can get close. Good reads can bring you to care about the protagonists nearly as much as you do your own loved ones. Lee, it makes them real. Sarah, often I finish a book and I think, I want more from Lagos. I want to know everything about Nairobi. A whole new world opens up to you. Reading is cumulative. It changes you and sustains you. That experience is what I hope to share. Let's move now to the Feeling Good section of the magazine, and remembering that this is Heart Month, this headline is Rescue Me. You, yes, you could save a person's life if you're armed with a few key techniques. What if the woman sitting next to you at brunch choked on a waffle? Or a stranger walking next to you collapsed on the sidewalk in cardiac arrest? Only one in 39 people who have a medical emergency in public receive help from a bystander. Yet even a little first aid know-how is enough to take action, says David Markinson, MD, chair of the American Red Cross Scientific Advisory Council. And the more you know, the better care you'll give. You can take a first aid class at the Red Cross, the American Heart Association, some fire stations, and other organizations. In the meantime, here's a quickie primer on how to help those in desperate need. First off, you see someone who looks like they're choking. What to know? If a person's airway isn't totally obstructed, their body can do a better job of clearing the object than a bystander can. Ask, are you choking? If they're able to talk or cough, encourage them to continue doing so. Call 911 and keep an eye on them. If they nod wordlessly, put their hands to their neck or can't cough, it means an object is blocking their airway. You need to act quickly. What to do? Try back blows and abdominal thrusts, aka the Heimlich maneuver. The Red Cross recommends alternating 5 blows with 5 thrusts until the blockage clears. Back blows. Stand behind and slightly to one side of the choking person and place one arm across their chest for support. Bend the person over at the waist so their body is parallel to the ground, and using the heel of your hand, deliver forceful blows between the shoulder blades. Abdominal thrusts. Stand behind the choking person, staggering your feet with one between theirs. Wrap your arms around their waist and tilt them forward slightly. Position one fist above the belly button but below the rib cage, then grasp it with your other hand. Imagine you're trying to lift the person, and quickly press up into the abdomen to dislodge the blockage. If this fails and they lose consciousness, move on to the steps below. And so the next set of instructions is, if you see someone who is unresponsive and not breathing, what to know? CPR is necessary whenever the heart ceases beating. Have someone call 911 and look for an AED. And an AED is an automated external defibrillator. In the meantime, get to work. What to do? If you've been taught conventional CPR using mouth-to-mouth breaths and are at least fairly confident you can do it correctly, go ahead, especially if you're assisting a child. However, if you've never learned CPR, use the hands-only technique. Research indicates that cardiac arrest patients have a higher survival rate when untrained bystanders administer hands-only CPR compared with conventional CPR, in part because they're more willing to try it. hands-only CPR. Kneel beside the person. Place the heel of one hand in the center of their chest. Place your other hand on top and interlace your fingers. Position your shoulders over your hands, arms straight, then push down hard, about 2 inches into the chest, and release quickly. Repeat to the beat of the song, Staying Alive, by the Bee Gees. Continue until the person starts to breathe or move. Conventional CPR. Give 30 chest compressions, count aloud, then 2 rescue breaths. To do so, open the person's airway by slightly tilting their head back and lifting their chin. Pinch their nose shut and use your mouth to make a seal over theirs. Blow into their mouth for about 1 second, making sure their chest rises. If it doesn't, retilt their head to properly open the airway. Give a second breath. Go back to compressions and continue until the person shows signs of breathing or movement. Here are a couple of footnotes. If the choking person is pregnant or obese, it may be difficult to reach around their stomach. Instead, wrap your arms around their chest. To perform either choking technique on a child, you may have to kneel down. When performing CPR chest compressions on a child under age 9, you need only use one hand. On babies, just 2 fingers. And now, shocking news. Automated external defibrillators, AEDs, shock a stopped heart to help restore normal rhythm. In a 2018 study, cardiac arrest patients were twice as likely to survive when bystanders used an AED before the ambulance arrived. This happened at the 2018 New York City Marathon. Yet the devices were used in only 19% of shockable cases. Next time you spot an AED, they're in schools, offices, gyms, and sports and concert venues, make a mental note. It could help you be a hero. And a health hero next. Download to lift up. Teen coder Amanda Southworth is helping people tap into better mental health. The spring before her freshman year of high school, a few months before the development of her first mobile app, 13-year-old tech whiz Amanda Southworth slid into her bathtub and took 10,000 milligrams of ibuprofen, about 50 times the standard dose. Reeling from a family argument and feeling like an outsider in her town, she wanted to die. But she lived. The next morning, Southworth managed to make it to school. She told no one what she'd done. Though she did imagine explaining to a teacher, I tried to kill myself last night, so I couldn't do the homework. Southworth, who grew up in suburbs around Los Angeles, describes herself as solitary by nature. She suffered in silence. Yet as she worried about what her teachers or counselors would say if they knew how she was feeling, she was overcome with a sense of purpose to help people with mental health issues get the support they need. Now 17 and the executive director of her own software development nonprofit, Astra Labs, Southworth, who began coding at age 10, has dealt with mental illness, anxiety, depression, PTSD, for most of her life. Unable to afford traditional talk therapy, she searched for an alternative form of treatment that was free and preferably digital. She says, quote, very simply, I looked for something accessible that would make me not want to hurt myself, and I couldn't find it, end of quote. So she decided to invent it. The result is her 3-year-old app, Anxiety Helper, a tool for people dealing with everything from depression to panic attacks. The features, which she updates regularly, are inspired by psychology research and conversations with fellow mental health sufferers. There are directions to nearby crisis centers, links to hotlines, and stress-relieving tools like a mini-game in which the user taps on screen bubble until it gets so big it bursts. She says, I wanted the app to help people not feel the way I felt. And it has. The app now serves more than 68,000 users, including one who, 6 months after the launch, contacted Southworth through social media to say, quote, I just want to thank you because your app saved my life, end of quote. More recently, inspired by the hostility she and some of her friends had experienced as members of the LGBTQ plus community, she developed a follow-up to Anxiety Helper, an LGBTQ plus safety app called Verena, a German name meaning protector. It's a resource for finding police stations, hospitals, and other places of refuge in times of need. The app also lets users designate a list of contacts to be alerted in case of emergency. Initially, she self-funded her enterprises through freelance design gigs and her allowance. But in December 2017, her fortune and future changed when she was presented with a $25,000 grant from the TOMS Social Entrepreneurship Fund at the Teen Vogue Summit in Los Angeles. Since then, she's been working on two new projects. Oculatum, an app that uses artificial intelligence to help psychosis patients deal with hallucinations. And Rally, a social media platform designed to assist protesters in safely and efficiently mobilizing, an idea she got while working with the LA chapter of March for Our Lives, the organization founded by the teen survivors of last year's Parkland, Florida school shooting. As empowering as her software is for the user, creating it has also boosted Southworth's well-being. Along with self-care, therapy, and medication, the fulfillment her projects provide has been life-changing in the best way. She says, quote, "I'm especially touched when I read reviews that say, 'I never thought I would have to use this app, but I did, and it really worked.' That makes me cry happy tears." As we wrap up this installment, let's listen to the answers, some answers to this month's question, how did you meet your significant other? Susan Christopher of Vienna, Virginia says, "When I moved to D.C., I had two dogs, two cats, and two birds. No one would rent to me, so I had to buy my first home. Before I met my mortgage banker, my father gave me info on rates and points, but when I walked into the bank, it was love at first sight. Soon after, I called my dad, who asked what rate I'd been offered. I had no idea. My husband and I have been together 22 years and have three kids, two dogs, and a cat." And we've run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I'm Susan Dullinger, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.